Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Donna Duffy.
Hey.
And I'm truly, truly grateful to be here. I'm really, really nervous, as you can probably tell, but the quaking of the voice will calm down as we go. My husband taught me a really valuable thing to do when you get up here before the podium and you're really, really nervous. He told me to start off with a joke, and then we'll get into the other stuff. So there's only one person that I know of in here that's from West Virginia. Is there anybody else in here from West Virginia?
This better be good.
Okay. There was a couple from West by God Smile when you say it, Virginia. And the wife was pregnant, and she started to have some contractions, and they lived up in the hills in West Virginia, and they didn't have many amenities. There was no lights, and there was no running water. And so they go back to the house, and the husband has to go down and get the MD down the road, so he trucks on down there, and he comes back, and he asks the doctor what he's supposed to do. He said, "You go boil some water and get me some rags and go light a lantern because dark's a-coming." So that's my vocabulary, Nancy. Where's she at? Nancy told me this morning that I have my own vocabulary, so y'all just bear with me. So he gets back to the house, and he's getting the rags together, and he's boiling the water, and he goes and lights the lantern, and the doctor tells him to rush into the room and bring the lantern with him. So he brings the water, and he brings the rags, and he brings the lantern. He says, "Now hold that lantern close here so I can see what I'm doing." So he holds the lantern up, and he says, no, get closer so I can really see what I'm doing." So he holds the lantern up there, and the baby is born, and the doctor's wiping the baby off, and he starts to hand it to the man, and the man puts the lantern on the shelf. He says, "Bring the lantern close. Bring the lantern close. There's another one coming." So he brings the lantern close. He said, "Bring it in so I can see what's happening." So he brings it in really, really close. And out comes another baby. He's wiping the baby off, goes to hand it to the daddy. Daddy goes to put the lantern on the shelf. He says, "Bring the lantern over. Bring it close." And he says, "You reckon this lantern's attracting him?" I love you, Diz. I am an alcoholic, and my name is Donna Duffy. I want to thank the committee. Diz invited me to speak, and, you know, for about a year now, I've been really, really nervous about it. And, of course, that's been the topic of my brain's activity for a year. And thinking about what I was supposed to get up here and say and who I was supposed to impress and all that stuff. And God keeps reminding me that I'm just a little tiny cog in the great big wheel of life. That's what he keeps reminding me about. Just calm down. And if I trust in that infinite God, he's going to intervene here and get all that quakiness out of my voice, and it's all going to be good. My sobriety date is September the 9th of 1997, and for that I'm truly, truly grateful. The committee has done a fantastic job thus far, and I have the utmost confidence that it's going to continue to get better. The committee works really, really hard, and I want to thank each and every one of them for making this all possible. John started off the workshop yesterday about these adventures, and he hit the nail right on the head with everything that he said. We have adventures before, and everybody, when I say that I'm an alcoholic, y'all know about those adventures. Y'all know about all of them. And there's been some, quite a few, that's happened. Some really, really exciting, and some that kind of makes me step back and think, wow, what am I doing here? I asked Diz this morning when I got here if I could bring a cheat sheet, and he told me yeah, and I was kind of surprised. I was really surprised. I was ready for him to say yeah, but I was kind of surprised, and I had it all folded up in my big book, because if he would have said no, it would have been right back in my big book. Diz Sister is my sponsor, and I do what he says. He's the first man in my whole life that I ever learned how to trust. He's the first man that taught me how to love. How to love unconditionally, and not only to love, but to be loved. He taught me all that, so he's responsible. I was there when I reached out. His hand was there, and for that, I'm truly, truly, eternally grateful. Let's see. I'm not going to tell you way back when I was born. I'm just going to let you know that I was a service brat. My daddy was in the Air Force, and we didn't travel around like a whole lot of families do. We traveled long distances. We went over to Japan when I was a young kid. And I was there from the time I was a year old until I was 5 1/2. And I came to grow very fond of a lady by the name of Kimiko. She was our maid. And that's not, I'm not telling you that to impress you. Everybody over there had maids, so we weren't anything special. But Kimiko came very close to me. I don't know if she got close to any of the rest of the kids, but she got close to me. And, of course, because I'm so special, I'm unique, you know. And we left Japan, and Mama at the time had four kids, and I was the youngest of those four kids. And we moved back to the States, and my daddy got stationed in Delaware, and that's where he ended up retiring at in 1971. And my dad, when I was a kid, he would always tell me this one little thing, and he'd say, "To thine own self be true. You better be true to yourself, because if you're not true to yourself, who are you going to be true to?" And you know, that never meant anything to me. It never meant anything to me because I was too afraid to ask any questions. I was afraid. I was that type of kid that if I asked a question, then you would know how dumb I was. I was afraid that if I revealed that side of me, that you would know what my mama always said. In public, my mom would tell me what a good kid I was to everybody else. But behind closed doors, I was dumb, I was stupid. And, you know, I believed her. I really, really believed her. That was my problem. I believed what she told me. So when my daddy would tell me stuff like that, I was afraid to ask because I didn't know what it meant. And who knows what would have happened with my life. The world would have probably been in real, real danger if I'd have known what that meant. I have a temper about me today, and it's not near as bad as it was. You know, the big book on page 66 talks about the grouch and the brainstorm. It might be the dubious luxury of normal men, but it's not for me. And what I've come to know is the grouch, kind of like when I'm out of that sunlight of the spirit and I'm getting up in the morning, I just don't want to get up, and the alarm goes off, and I want to hit the snooze, but I got this thing about alarm clocks with snoozes. I don't want to get up. I just don't. And it's not that I don't want to live today. There's just sometimes I'd rather sleep in. But I have priorities, and I have obligations, and I have a responsibility to commitments that I make. So that grouch, that slow burn, I have to be really, really conscious of that today. And then it gets in, and it talks about the brainstorm. And, you know, in my generation, what brainstorm is a sudden bright idea. That's not what they were talking about in 1935. And if you get a Webster's unabridged dictionary, trust me, I did this. If you get a Webster's unabridged dictionary, the first definition is a sudden violent rage. And Donna was the alcoholic who had never had a drink that was capable of total destruction when I erupted. My mother would tell me I erupt like a volcano. And that's what I did. I would get into that slow burn, and it would boil and boil and boil, and then all of a sudden, the slightest little thing, Mama could call me a name, Irene could tease me, the slightest little thing would make me erupt like a volcano. And what y'all have taught me is to turn a whole lot of things over to God and not to take myself so darn serious and to keep things into perspective so that that temper kind of gets wavered because I depend on a power that's far greater than me to intervene in all that. I don't have to erupt anymore. Do I get mad? Yeah, I do. I do, but I don't act like that. There was a time that I was so angry that I got up at the table, and I had two kids sitting there witnessing this, and I was so angry I took the jar of mayonnaise off of the table, and I threw it as hard as I could. And I don't know about you, but, you know, mayonnaise in glass jars breaks real easy. This mayonnaise jar had so much velocity behind it, it went straight through the wall. That's this alcoholic, and that's the anger that I'm capable of. And I don't want to live like that today. I just don't. And y'all help me with that. Each and every time I go to a meeting, every time I ask a question to y'all, because you see I'm not scared to ask questions anymore, y'all let me know that I don't have to have that kind of anger in me today. I know what to do with it because I have a sponsor that teaches me how to live. My oldest sister got pregnant when she was 16. And there again, there's this kid that doesn't ask any questions. And I was really, really naive. I was short and fat and wore glasses. And I just wear contacts today. It's really the difference. All I heard in that conversation, my mother was really, really going off the deep end. And all I heard in that conversation was she kissed him. My perception right away was, if you kiss a boy, you're going to get pregnant. And I was 12. So I was real scared of boys. So I started riding bikes with boys. You know, they became my best buddy. Because if I was friends with them, then, you know, they wouldn't want to do anything with me, like kiss me. So my middle sister, who's 15 months older than me, I'm really, really close to her. I love her dearly. Anytime I'm having a bad time or a good time, she always knows. And she lives alone about 5 hours from me, and she can call me just at the right time. God intervening through her is just so awesome how that happens. Very, very close to her. She got pregnant when she was 17. And what she told my mother was, I took a few pills and I drank a few beers, and the last thing I remember is we started kissing. That perception, it was just cemented, if you kiss a boy, you're going to get pregnant. So we've moved up to Idaho. My mom and dad were divorced when I was 12. We moved down to Florida with my mama, and she got married about 3 months after that, and we moved up to a little town right outside of Boise called Nampa. It's not so little anymore. And I started going to school and all that kind of stuff. And there was a boy that came up and asked me out on a date. And I thought to myself, I'm going to fix him. I'm going to tell him he can only date me if we go out with another couple. And there was a girl named Rita and another guy named Wes. And we went out with Kirby. And the reason I wanted to go out with Kirby is because he's had this purple 65 Mustang with a black convertible top and had real shiny wheels on it. I wasn't so much interested in him, but I sure did want to ride in that car. I wanted y'all to see how special I was riding in that car. So we get in the car, and the first thing he does is go to the store, and he gets this big old brown bag, brings it outside, and he had to be 18 back then to be legal to drink and or buy liquor. And he twists the top off, and he pulls it out of the bag, and it's a bottle of Boone's Farm Wild Mountain Grape. He takes him a big old swig of it and passes it back to Wes. Rita took her some, too, and passed the bottle up to me, and I didn't give it up. I drank the rest of it. That's just what I do. Every time I get a drink. If you go buy a six-pack, you're going to drink all six. If you buy a case, you may as well drink all of them. And if you're going to buy a couple cases, I'm going to need some help because I can't drink all that at one time by myself. But I would have tried. That's how I drank. That's just how I drank. So we went out on that date, and I ended up drinking that Wild Mountain Grape, and the end result was not very pleasant, as I'm sure a lot of y'all could realize. But I'm going to tell you something. From the first time that I took that swig until the repercussions happened, I grew to 5'10". I had real long, blonde, flowing locks, and I looked really, had long legs, real long legs. And you know, in the program where it tells us that we're 10 foot tall and bulletproof, I was 5'10 and bulletproof. That's just what, I had no inhibitions. I was not scared anymore. And I didn't have to ask any questions because I knew everything. You know? I was just that type. And fun. I was the type that'd do cartwheels in snowbanks. It was a blast. It was really, really a blast. But then the repercussions come. And I remembered them. That shortly thereafter, I won a bet and I won a fifth of vodka. And somebody told, I didn't know how to drink it. Somebody told me if I'd mix it with tomato juice or orange juice that it would, you know, go down better. And I didn't share. I opened that, broke the seal on the bottle, and I poured the half a gallon of orange juice into a Kool-Aid pitcher, and I poured that vodka in there, and I proceeded to sit down and drink. About 30 minutes later, it was gone. And that's when I learned how to do cartwheels in snowbanks. And from the time I took that first sip of that vodka until the bottom of the bottle came and those repercussions happened, I was 5'10", had that real long, blonde, flowing locks going all around me, long, lanky legs, 5'10", and bulletproof. And I knew everything. That's what alcohol did for this drunk. I did not get here by roasting marshmallows in front of a campfire. I just didn't. I lived in Delaware, or I went lived in Idaho for a while, sorry. And then my mama had left me up there. I was working at Buy Candy's restaurant. Everything was going cool. Superintendent found out I was a minor child. I was only 17 and told me I had to go live with mama or daddy, and I had to pick. So I picked my dad, and I went to Delaware for just a little bit and decided to go back down to Florida. And everything was rocking and rolling pretty good, and somehow, some way, I managed to graduate out of high school, and I don't know how. And just before I got out of high school, there was a guy that kind of crossed my path, and I kind of liked him because I liked his brother, and he didn't want to date me, so I dated him just to spite his brother. Say, see what you're missing? I'm so special. So I married him, and it wasn't too pleasant of a marriage. When he drank like I did, and he did a whole lot of extracurriculars. So I thought to fix him that I just wouldn't drink, and then he might slow down a little bit. Well, that didn't happen because he drank his and mine too, and it was all good. It was all good, and I would go on these binges, you know, because I'd only get to that place where that volcano was about to erupt, and I'd go on a binge, and I could get away with the brainstorm on the binges. Because I was a happy drunk. If I didn't have alcohol in me, I don't know what I would have done. I would have done that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and become evil, mean, and nasty. Throwing mayonnaise jars through walls and breaking cabinet doors and slamming the dishes in the sink. That's what I'd become if I didn't have liquor in me. So, the more I drank, the better I liked it. Life rocks and rolls on. For about 3.5 years, the marriage lasted. And Mark became a significant thing for this alcoholic. I divorced him, and I had a couple of broke ribs and some bashed up face and a ruptured eardrum, and my left eye was damaged, and that's pretty much the reason I have to wear contacts today. And it's all good. It is all good. I stayed divorced for about a year, and I met this guy in a bar, and met him on a Thursday, moved in with him on a Saturday. And I married him shortly thereafter. And we had a miracle happen in my life. And her name is Allison. Allison will be 25 on July the 17th. Man, I'm getting old. This child is so important to my sobriety. She's an awesome kid. She is so awesome. Allison happened, and then the marriage didn't. And you see, because that husband, what I expected out of him, he just didn't live up to my expectations. I got mad and divorced him. That's really what happened. And I stayed divorced for 2 weeks and decided to marry another guy that I dated in between one and two. And that marriage lasted about 8 months, and there was no miracles. I just learned how to drink a lot because I had to drink a lot to keep up with him. And I could have qualified really good for Al-Anon at that time because I was the wife that would go tote him out of the truck at 3 o'clock in the morning when he managed to get there and park in the ditch. He didn't realize he was in the ditch. Had lots of fun. I would have qualified if I had just known about Al-Anon. Maybe I would have went. I don't know. God has wonderful ways of bringing it all together. So I left. I moved from Tucson, Arizona. Actually, I didn't leave. He told me I had to leave because I went out and got drunk and came home at 4 o'clock in the morning. Did the same things he did. And he just didn't like it. So he thought that it'd be best if I left. So I did. And I moved back to Florida. And we divorced. And I stayed divorced for about a year. And I met this guy. I was at a co-ed softball team, the tournament. And I liked what he looked like when he was walking away from me. And I said, I got to meet this guy. So I go up to my brother-in-law and I said, who is he? And he says, oh, he's just quirky. You don't want to meet him. And I said, yes, I do. Yes, I do. I like what he looks like. So anyway, we met and he moved in the next day. And within just a matter of months, we were married again, and I had a huge miracle happen again, and her name is Courtney, and she'll be 20 years old on April the 18th, and she is not a part of my life, and that's okay today, too. I'm grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for the love that y'all give me to show me the courage to get through something like that. There were some extracurriculars that I got involved with. I was a bookkeeper, and I decided to make husband number 4 what I thought he should be. So in order to do that, I needed to indulge in the books and manipulate them and lie to my boss and cheat on the books, and I ended up stealing a whole bunch of money. And I got caught, and I did what I thought would be the best thing to do, and that's just exit. So I went home and I called my sister after my arrest and asked her what to do. And she says, pack your stuff, pack the kids' stuff, and come on up here. And I said, all right. And she was in Delaware at the time. And I did that. I followed directions really well when I'm scared. So I went up to Delaware and made a new life for myself. My brother-in-law helped me really, really commit some really huge crimes, and that's changing identities and changing Social Security numbers and making sure that my kids were taken care of. He did all that for me. He put me to work. He owned a plumbing business at the time, so I learned what it's like to dig ditches. I learned what it's like to pipe a house. And I'm not volunteering my services because it has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, but if there's a meeting room around here that needs faucet change, I'm willing to do it. I can do that today. About, a year into the Delaware trip, I was on a construction site, and, you know, there's this guy driving this backhoe, and we had to have clean out dug, and he's from West by God Smile When You Say It, Virginia. And that's why I use that in my joke. Not because it is. It has everything to do with husband number five. So I had another victim. And he asked me out on a date. And I said, if I go with you, you have to take my kids. And so we went to a movie, had pizza and all that kind of stuff. Well, what goes good with pizza is beer. So we sat there and we drank. And I discovered that he drank like I did. So I knew I was going to be safe with him. So he moved in and we ended up getting married. And then this really perturbing thing happened. The state troopers and the city cops just kind of gathered around my house on July the 7th of 1989, and they didn't particularly like who they was coming to get because they had discovered me. And they had the fugitive warrant, and they brought this great big old picture. Why'd they make those pictures so big? This great big picture had to be 25 by 17, I know. Is this you? Yeah, you can see my nose hair, same pattern. Yeah, that's me. So they arrested me, and that's the moment that I lost the custody of my children. Courtney was three and a half. Just turned three in April, and this is July, so I like to say three and a half, pushing her age a little bit. And she was completely hysterical. Allison was 10 days shy of being eight, and Allison was the one that Mommy never lied to. Allison was fully expecting this to happen, and she knew exactly what to do. She went right to Steve, and she said, Steve, you got to get us out of here. That was husband number five's name. And she said, you got to get us out of here, because Mommy said if they ever came, you got to leave. And he couldn't move. He was just frozen. He did what he was supposed to do. He waited for the child custody services to come and gather up my kids, and Courtney was screaming and hollering. If it had not been for that eight-year-old, I don't know what would happen to her, the little one. I just don't know. She probably went nuts, kind of like her mama. So I get to jail and have to wait for the governor's warrant to come through, so I'm just kind of sitting there. You know, that slow burn starts. They took my kids, and I didn't know where they were. And I finally got bailed out for a little bit while I was waiting on that governor's warrant to come. And when I got out, I started making some phone calls and tried to locate the kids. And the only reason I knew, found out where Courtney was, is because she was to the point to where she wouldn't eat. She just wanted to see her mama. And Corky had to call me. And it was a blessing for me because I got to tell him what to do, and he listened. Because I told him to go boil some potatoes while I was talking to her on the phone. Go boil some potatoes and mash them up, and that's what she would eat for real. When she wouldn't eat anything else, she'd eat mashed potatoes. So he did that, and she started eating. And she talked to me for a little bit, and she wanted to know when she was going to see me and all that. And I told her, honestly, I didn't know. I don't know. You just do what you're supposed to do. You be a good girl for Mommy, and you be a good girl for Daddy, and you're going to be okay. So things got to rocking on a little bit, and I went before the judge, and I got 5 years probation. I was shocked. I was shocked. And I had such a great job in Delaware that I decided to go back to Delaware. The job, the boss decided to hold my job for me. And I went back up to Delaware and started fighting for custody of my kids. And that slow burn started, and it was growing, growing, growing. And poor old husband number five, he didn't do what I expected him to do, and I was really, really mad. And this is where the mayonnaise jar type anger comes about. And we had a big blow up once, and I told him I was moving to my daddy's house, and he couldn't come. And he said, but I don't have anywhere to go. And my daddy said, well, you can come over here. You can just sleep in a different room. And I didn't like that too much. But Daddy didn't like the idea that Steve was one of my victims. And he didn't like the idea that I was booting him out. And he didn't have anywhere to go. So Daddy let him move in. And it was shortly thereafter that he found a place to live. And I was flying back and forth every quarter to go see the kids and come down for court hearings, and nothing ever worked. Nothing. I wasn't getting my way. I didn't like it. And one of my trips down, I asked the judge what it was going to take to get the custody of my children. She says, I can't promise you'll ever get custody, but if you'll give it some time, you'll be able to see them on a regular basis. so they granted me visitation with them every other weekend, 3 hours at a time, and they had to be separate. They wouldn't trust me in the same room with them both, and that was okay. I was glad I was able to see them. So the slow burn kept growing, and I started acting out, you know, drinking a lot and all that stuff, things that I do, just the things that I do. And that 5'10 woman decided that she was going to get mean and nasty, and it just wasn't a very pleasant picture. So husband number 5 became history. And on one of my trips down to Florida, I called up an old friend of mine, happened to be a man, and I asked him if he wanted to go over and see Allison with me. And I said, I don't want you to go over there to the house with me. I'd just like for you to ride with me if that's all right. He said, sure, just drop me off at the bar on the way. And I said, all right. So I went and I saw Allison for about 3 hours, and I came back out, and he was drinking. I had a beer, and we went on about our business. Next day, went and got married. That's what we did. It was a fairy tale marriage. This guy was from the right side of the tracks, extremely wealthy family. Mom and Daddy always took good care of him. Didn't work, didn't have to. Had a really nice house at Santa Rosa Beach, right on the bay, and I loved it. I mean, this was just like a fantasy come true for this alcoholic. It was awesome. I felt like I had awakened. I had arrived, like Phil said. And it was nothing about that. It was nothing about that because this guy drank like I did. And he did some extracurriculars that I wasn't too fond of. And the reason I wasn't too fond of it is because what my sister said years before, she said she took a few pills and she kissed him. And I was afraid that if I took a few pills, that something else might happen. And I'd always heard about this other stuff being so bad. So I had an attitude against it. And I truly learned what open-mindedness was about then. Because he asked me to have some open minds about some of the things that he was doing. And I did. And one night we were watching a movie. And the movie's title was New Jack City. And my perception of that movie was, I could make a whole lot of money real quick, and I could pay off all those debts, and my life would smooth out. Everything would be all right. So I turned to this man who obviously had some experience that I didn't have, and I started asking him questions about this. And he said, yeah, you can do that. You can do that. And if you know what it does to you, you probably sell it more effectively. I said, okay. So he took me, and I tried his idea of what would help me a lot, and within 6 months I had gone through the savings account, put a mortgage on the house, and embezzled $36,000 from the boss that I was working for. So naturally Donna packs her stuff and cuts out, and I end up in Alabama at my other sister's house, the one that took a couple of pills and kissed the guy. And she took me in for a while, and the law found me, and I moved down to Florida because I got out of their reach. I don't know how. I don't know. It was by skin of my teeth that I left and ended up back down in Florida. And I stopped doing what I did for a little while. And I met this guy. He was a blind cowboy. And if y'all ever see PRCA-sanctioned buck and bronco riders, his name is David Lord. And, of course, I didn't use my right name with him, but I'm like, golly, this is a perfect guy. He's blind, and because John Walsh thinks I'm so important, he's going to put me on Saturday night. When I go on that Saturday night, America's Most Wanted, he won't know who I am. He can't see. Perfect setup. I thought it was great. Within a few months, the Baldwin County Sheriff's Department was beating on my door. And let me tell you what happened in between the time I met this guy and the time that sheriff's department came beating down the door. I had went over to Crestview. This is on September the 6th of 1993. Went over to Crestview where my mama lived, borrowed $40 from her, went down, did what I do. And I met someone, set up an appointment to meet him that following Friday. This was on a Wednesday. And I didn't have any money to go do what I was going to do, but I had a check in my pocket. And that check had David Lord's name on it. He had turned all that responsibility over to me, and he had a lot of money in his bank. A lot of money. I was going to do what I do. Lie, cheat, steal, and manipulate. On the way back, September the 6th, it had approached midnight, on the way back to Baldwin County, he lived in Alberta, Alabama. I was driving down the interstate on I-10, and I had about a half a beer left. And of course, my half a beer is I bought them great big old bottles. Had about a half a beer left, and I'm going down the highway, and I don't know what happened, but I call it my bottom. I get to that place that the big book talks about, that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I didn't know if I wanted to live, and I didn't know if I wanted to die. I didn't know if I had the courage to off myself, you know. I just didn't know what to do. I had hit the brick wall. So, going down the road, I get in bed 3:30 in the morning, 7 o'clock, Baldwin County Sheriff's Department is there, and they arrest me, and they have, big picture, 17 by 25, is this you? Yes, it's me. I get in the sheriff's department car, and I didn't have any problem with extradition at that point. I signed all the necessary papers. November 17th of 1993, I was extradited and went back over to Crestview. And that night, there was a lady there. Her name was Faye. And she brought a meeting there that was kind of like a church thing. And I asked if I could go. And only because I knew the officers there, because that's my hometown, where my mom is from, is Oakless County. The only reason that I was allowed to go is because they knew me and I wasn't a flight risk. Believe it or not, they trusted that I wouldn't try to leave. And I go down there, and Miss Faye's talking about a loving God and a forgiving God. And she was looking right at me, you know, big old room full of all kinds of people. And she was looking right at me, of course. And she was telling me about this God. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no God that would love me, that would forgive me, that would, like me. Right where I'm at? I don't think so. So after the meeting, I'll go up to her, and I said, Miss Faye, could you tell me about this God? And she said, yeah, I'll be happy to. So she went on and told me some things. And she said, Donna, if you would just ask God to help you, he will. I said, surely it can't be that simple. She said, yeah, it truly is. So I went back, and I said what my husband refers to as the foxhole prayer. I was on that plastic mattress with the plastic pillow, and I cried into it. And I didn't want anybody to hear me crying, you know, because I'm so tough. I'm so big and bad, you know, the 10-foot tall and bulletproof. I didn't want anybody to see that I was weak. That was my moment of surrender. And all I said was, God, please help me. There was no strikes of lightning. There was no bolts of thunder. But I'm going to tell you something that happened to Donna. I have what I call a blessed assurance from within. And it's like a total release of the bondage that I was under. And nothing spectacular, you know, the doors didn't open or slide or anything like that. Nothing like that happened. But something happened inside of me. So the next day I asked for help. And I started getting it. And things started happening pretty quickly in my life. And through a sequence of God events and a lot of meetings with judges, I ended up with a 12-year term to be served at the Department of Corrections in the state of Florida. And I'm going to tell you something. A lot of you might go, but I was facing 45 years to life. So I believe that God was a true intervener right then on that day that I had those sentences imposed on me and had a lot of charges, and that's the bottom line of what it was. It was a 12-year prison sentence followed by 10 years probation because, you know, they want their money back. So they have to watch me to make sure that I pay that money back. So sequence of God events happen. End up going to Lowell Prison for the reception and orientation. And that was a really humiliating experience. And I asked how come they were so mean. And I asked how come they yell at you. And what the sergeant on duty at that particular time told me was, we break you down so we can build you back up. And I said, well, I'm broke. Can we start building now? Please don't yell anymore. So we go to classification, and then we get sent places, and I told them where I wanted to go. I wanted to go to Jefferson because my family would be closest to me up in Monticello, and it's just by the grace of God that I got there, because what classification told me was, we'll put you anywhere we want to. I said, yes, ma'am, I know you will, but you asked me where I'd prefer to go, so I answered the question. So I got to go to Jefferson Correctional Institute. It was a woman's facility at the time, and from what I can understand now, it's turned into a men's facility, and so I got over to Jefferson, and a lot of God events happened for me. And when I got there, I told them how special I was and how smart I was and that I really needed to work up at administration, you know, because I was real organized and I could keep the books. I could do payroll and all that stuff, you know. And the sergeant was so impressed. She said, "Here's your equipment." She handed me a rubber glove, a plastic bag, and a broom. And she said, "You will pick up cigarette butts." And I said, "You don't understand. I don't smoke." She said, "I know." So it was a very humbling experience. And I'm going to tell you, that's God moving for me. Because I got to stay all by myself, walk along the compound, all along the sidewalks, and picking up cigarette butts. And at first, I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. And I made every kind of excuse in this alcoholic's head not to do it. But I did it anyway. Sequence of God events happened, and I ended up being a clerk up there in the chaplain's office. It was pretty cool. I got to see the assistant warden that came in every day. She was the assistant superintendent, I guess is the title. And she would come in. Her name is Fran Barber. She'd come in every single day and share her spirituality with all of us. And then a couple months passed, and I heard about this private facility that was going to be for drug offenders. And it had no fences. It only had one dorm, no chow hall, and there was only a few inmates there at the time. The guards didn't wear any guns. There were no towers. It was a really cool place to go, and this is the best part. They served Kentucky Fried Chicken, and they had Charmin toilet paper. This is what I was hearing on the compound, and I said, "I got to go. I got to go because I'm so special." So I asked Miss Barber the next day. I said, "Miss Barber, there's this place over there in Gadsden County." She said, "Oh, I guess you've heard the rumors." And I said, "Rumors?" And she said, "Yeah, you've heard about it not having any fences and the guards don't have uniforms." She said, "Donna, you don't want to go over there. It's so disorganized. You just don't want to go." I said, "Miss Barber, you just don't understand. I really want to go." She said, "You want to go because you've heard about Kentucky Fried Chicken and Charmin toilet paper, haven't you?" I said, "Well, yes, ma'am." And I said, "Is it possible for me to go?" I said, "I can't get into the drug dorms over here because of my length of my sentence." It was a 12-year sentence, and they let all the short-timers get in. And everybody that would be bumped up in front of me had a chance at recovery so they could get out on the street and the little seed could come to fruition and the world would be a happier place. And I didn't have any choice in the matter. So I told her it would probably be a good chance for me to get some help if I was allowed to go over to Gadsden. She believed me. Next Tuesday morning, I was transferred over there to Gadsden Correctional Institute. And when I got there, after my busload got off, there were 54 women there. And there were no uniforms, so I got to put on jeans and a T-shirt. It was awesome. Had my own clothes. They took away all our makeup. I didn't wear makeup anyway, so it was no big deal. I got to see a lot of women go through changes. It was funny. And there was no rules. You know, our rules were about 8.5 by 11. Sheet of paper was about half. There were 6 rules, and you just had to get up on time. You had to go to bed on time and had to listen to what the other people said, you know. And it was really, really neat. The guards had blue jeans and T-shirts. There were no fences up. There was one dorm, and the inmates that were there at the time were helping build another dorm in the chow hall. And that night, we had a catered dinner. It was Kentucky Fried Chicken, and there was Charmin toilet paper in every single stall there was. And we had a big screen television, probably about half as big as that sign right there, and all of us were sitting there munching down on a catered dinner and enjoying a movie, you know. And I said, "This is the life." And then within probably 3 months, rules started being made, inmates started coming in, the drug dorm was starting to come to fruition. And about 6 months into my stay there, there was the program Recovery Dynamics came to be. And through a sequence of God events, I ended up being classified out to work in the warehouse. And I was in charge of all the inventory there. And there was a guy that would come out there, and he would get the caustics for the recovery dorm. And his name is Diz. He was the director of the programs there. And he would say things, you know, we'd sit there and chat for a little bit. And I just kind of liked how he lived. It was really neat for him to be just so calm, cool, and serene and mix all this chaos. It was just total chaos all the time there. Everything was really, really disorganized. And they needed him and other people like him to kind of bring things into perspective so that all of us would start acting right, you know, and enforcing the rules, that kind of stuff. And so he came about, and I started asking him questions. And I liked the answers that I was getting. And I'm like, wow, I wonder if this stuff could be for me. I wonder, wonder, wonder. And about, I don't know, a month or so later, I was walking off the compound after count, headed for the dorm, and they was having chicken that night, so I was going to make sure I was in the cafeteria. And Diz called me in his office. And it really, really scared me, because when you get called by a supervisor or a director, you've done something wrong. So what I've done all the way, I was about from here to the hotel rooms there, all the way I was saying, oh, my gosh, what have I done? What did somebody say I did? Did somebody believe it? All this stuff going around in my head, those little committees, they just chatter, chatter, chatter. And I get in there, and he asked me if I'd consider chairing a meeting on a Wednesday night there. And I said, I don't know how to do that. He said, can you read directions? And I said, yes, sir. So he hands me this notebook about like this one here, and he opens it up, and he said, read that. And I did, and he said, do you think you can follow the directions for the meeting? And I said, sure. I said, I'm scared to death. I don't know if I can do it or not. He says, well, the only way you can do is try. I said, okay. So I started chairing the meeting on Wednesday night. And you know what I found out? I found out that everybody in there was just like me. I no longer was plagued with that terminal uniqueness. It was pretty cool what they said. I remembered feeling like that. I remember doing that. You drank just like I did. It was awesome. It was really awesome. As sick as this head was, I felt like my lottery had just come to be. I felt like I needed to be there. You know, because I was the inmate that said, I really don't belong here. You know, I suffered with that terminal uniqueness for a while I was in there. I didn't belong there. I couldn't affiliate with anybody. I really was scared to, actually, to truth be known. So I started chairing the meeting and kind of enjoyed it. And then I got to go into the other meetings that they had. They had 7 meetings a week there. And there was a Tuesday night meeting and there was a Thursday night meeting where there was what we called outside sponsors that would come in. And on the Tuesday night meeting, it was pretty cool. We'd read out a big book and all that kind of stuff. And on Thursdays, everybody looked forward to Thursdays. There was this dude that came. His name was Tommy. He'd come, and he'd come early. The meeting didn't start till 8 o'clock, and at 6:30, you could count on him being there, you know? And I didn't drink coffee, but I'd sure be there. I'd, you know, go help make coffee or make all kinds of excuses just to be up there to get some of this stuff that y'all have. I just wanted to learn how to live, right? So Tommy was instrumental in me wanting to get into Recovery Dynamics. Because of that terminal uniqueness that I was convinced that I had, I thought that I could get this stuff just by osmosis, that I just listened to what y'all said, that I'd be all right, you know. I could just get all the answers by gleaning what you would tell me. So Tommy told me that I had to work the steps. And in order to do that, it'd be best, perhaps, for this alcoholic if I was in a structured environment. So I went to classification, and I asked if I could get into Recovery Dynamics. And they told me if they had a bunk available, that I'd get into the dorm. So I went, and Marlene was standing outside on the sidewalk. And I went up to her, and I said, Marlene, is it possible for me to get into Recovery Dynamics? And she said, no, all the bunks are full. And I did the absolute taboo of an inmate. I reached out, and I took her shirt in my hands. I didn't touch her, but I touched her shirt. And I thought, Marlene, you don't understand. I really, really, really need some help. And what I'm told is, if I can get into Recovery Dynamics, that my life can change and I don't have to come back. She said, she looked at me, she's got these big old eyes, and she looked at me, she says, why don't you come in here with me? And she took me in there, and Cindy was in there, it was Diz's clerk. And she asked Cindy, she said, Cindy, do we have any bunks available? And all she was doing was trying to impose on me the truth, that there was no room in the inn, that I had to wait until the next round. Cindy says, Marlene, I just got a paper from classification. It was a request form for a girl. She didn't want to get in. So Marlene looked at me and she says, I guess you're in. And I got into Recovery Dynamics. And when I got in there, I learned about step one. I learned about the power of surrender. I learned about relinquishing myself to a power that's far greater than me. I learned about that. I didn't do it yet, but I learned about it. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that without a question. I had a problem with the unmanageability part. Marlene says, Donna, won't you look around? There's razor wire and there's fences all around you. What do you mean your life is not unmanageable? You know? Because I was always under the impression if I managed better, and I was real organized, if I managed better, my life would improve, and that's not it at all. You know, I endured the consequences of my behavior. That's where the unmanageability came about. And in step two, I had this big issue with this God thing. My dad's an atheist, my mother's a Southern Baptist, my mama didn't go to church. And the only God that I knew of had a last name in my house. So I didn't know about this until Faye told me about him. So I go up to Marlene, and I said, how can I come to believe in anything that I don't believe in anyway? and she's just about the size of Dottie Lou, and she sat on the corner of her desk, and she folded those little old arms, and she said, "Donna, do you believe that I believe in God?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I do." She said, "There you go, you believe in something." I said, "You tricked me." She says, "No, I didn't. I just want you to know how simple it is to believe in something you don't know anything about. If you have a conception, that's all you need. That's all you need." And I kind of like that. I kind of like that because out of all the blanks, and we're reading right out of the big book. It was awesome. It really, really was. Making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God means that I have to do something. And that's when the rubber hit the road for this alcoholic. Because, you see, I thought if I just believed what you said, that everything would be all right. So I could believe that I'd made a decision and I could go on and do the rest of the steps, but I would just listen to what y'all would say and everything would be all right. And that's not what the step means. This alcoholic had to act like somebody would act if they had turned their will and their life over to the care of God. Did I like it? No. I was real uncomfortable because that's when accountability started. I had to start being accountable for what I said to you. I had to start being accountable for what I did every day. I had to start being accountable for the impression that I would leave on other people. And when I was chair in that meeting, I had to be accountable for what was said in there and the conduct that was going on. I got a little comfortable with that. Marlene told me the more I practiced it, the better it would be. And then we got on to step four, and I didn't have any problem writing all these resentments down. I didn't have a problem with that at all. Not a problem at all. But when I got past that third column and the big book tells us that we're supposed to go back and we're supposed to realize how sick these other people were, and I'm supposed to get myself out of it and realize that these two are sick people, I didn't like that too much. I didn't like it. But I did it. I did it because of the fear that I have for getting drunk. Because by then, I had developed this love for this program. And I just wanted the pain to stop. So I was willing to go on through with it. I got through that fourth column, and then we got to the fear list. And something occurred to me on page 68 in the big book. It says, "All men of faith have courage." And what these people have always told me, Diz included now, he said, the more faith you have, the less fear you'll have. And I had this huge problem with fear. I had been scared my whole life, terrified. And when I read that sentence, "All men of faith have courage," you know what happened to this brain? I said, wow, I can still have faith. And I can be scared because I wouldn't need courage if I wasn't scared. All men of faith have courage. I love that. It's highlighted, underlined. Every big book I've ever had is like that. All men of faith have courage. It was such an incredible turning point for this alcoholic. What Diz told me was, "What do I do about fear?" was my question. He said, "Donna, you have to ask for the courage to act in spite of your fear. And then the fear is overcome." And it's the truth. It just works that way. It's awesome how this stuff works. So we get on to the sexual inventory, and y'all have already heard all that. That was a no-brainer for me. You know, it was real fun writing about all that kind of stuff. And then I got to that place where I had to tell my fifth step. You know, I had to divulge to somebody, not only to God and myself. That was easy. I had to say it out loud, which kind of made me feel stupid, but I did it on a real early Sunday morning out on the rec yard, and everybody else slept in on Sunday morning, so I went out there by myself, and I admitted to God all of that stuff. And then a miracle happened in my life. There was this girl named Susan. She came on the compound, and she started walking around the rec yard like I did every day, and she started coming to meetings, and it was just meant for me. I gravitated toward her. It was meant for me to ask her to listen to my fifth step, and she did. She did. She was very patient. She was very kind, very loving, pointed out some things to me that really, really helped. Really, really helped. Gave me the instructions on page 75 what to do after I was finished. And I did exactly what the book says. And I literally put my book on the shelf so I could take it off. I literally did that. I wanted to do exactly what the book said. And then she told me to flip the page over when I was done with step five. And it says, if we have answered these questions to our satisfaction, we then go on to step six. That means that there's no time involved. I have to go on to step six. And, you know, step six to me, God bless you, at the time was easy because it's just a little old bitty place there on top of page 76. Step six, okay, I can do this. Here's my character defects. And step seven was a breeze. It's just a prayer, you know. I can do this. Then we get on to step eight. I was real excited. because they told me that I could use step 4 in step 8. There are some other people that were listed on step 8 that weren't on step 4. But still, Diz helped me a lot. He told me if I'd put him in columns, the people that I was willing to make amends to right now, going in the first column, people I was willing to make amends to but just felt a little uncomfortable with goes in the second column. That third column were people that I wasn't sure if I was going to be willing to make amends to them or not. I had to work on that. And that fourth column was for the never. I will never make amends. There was one person in that column. And I'm going to tell you what happened. When I got that, all my columns finished and I got on to step 9, started making amends, had to write letters, make a lot of phone calls. That's how I made my amends. That's how the big book told me to do. And that the guy that was in the fourth column comes all the way over, and he's the gentleman that I stole all that money from. And he by and large, was responsible for me spending some time in prison. And I can't say I blame him. He wanted me to spend all that 45 years, you know, and the judge saw different. And so I started making those amends, and he gets over to that first column, and I said, Diz, what do I do? He said, are you willing? I said, yes, sir. He said, that's what you got to do. Now go on. So then I got to step 10, and I like that step because I have to be accountable. I have to be responsible. Do I like it all the time? No, I don't, because this alcoholic fails and stumbles and comes out of the sunlight of the Spirit a lot, and I like what John said in his workshop, how that road just gets narrow and narrow and narrow. It does. It does. When I get in those weeds and those rocks, I got to pull the bootstraps up because my flip-flops are getting uncomfortable. You know, I can't go lackadaisical walking on this path. And step 11, you know, in step 10 in the big book, what it tells us upon awakening, it gives us explicit instructions what to do every day. This alcoholic follows those directions. I ask God to direct my way of thinking. That's the only reason I don't have to drink today, is because I'm allowing God to intervene. And step 11, if I keep that conscious contact with God, I'm going to be okay today. I know I am. Do I fail miserably? I stumble so much so that I skink my nose up and God brushes me off and puts me right back on that path and I'm allowed to go on. It's a forgiving God and a loving God that I believe in today. And step 12, carrying the message, whew, it's a heck of an obligation. In the meeting this morning, Clay read I think he read the steps, and right at the end he said, I am responsible. Whenever anyone, anywhere reaches out, I want the hand of AA to be there, and for that I'm responsible. And I take that really, really seriously today. One of the greatest glories that happened to me was when somebody came up and asked me to be their sponsor. And, of course, you know, I'm responsible, and I'm going to make sure that they get to their meetings, and I'm going to caretake, and I'm going to enable, and all that stuff. And I screwed up really well. I did. But y'all helped me through that. You know, my husband turned me onto this book, and it has to do with sponsorship. And it's on a spiritual realm, and it lets me know that I'm not responsible for what they do. I'm only responsible for what I do. So if I can live and teach them by example, by coaching them through the steps and doing the things that I do, chances are they're not going to drink. But if they decide to, it's not my fault. But I'm going to tell you something. I don't get the glory when they stay sober. Keeps me really right-sized. Coming up on December of 1996, another miracle happened for me. They come and knocked on my bunk and told me I was going to work release. I said, me? I get to qualify? And let me tell you, that's a reward for faith. That's a reward for faith. Because you see, they'd call people up, bang on their bunk at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, tell them to go pack their stuff, there'd be an emergency release. And I got jealous. I got really, really jealous and pouting and pulling that tray tight once I got up in that high chair, whapping on that tray saying, why can't I do it? I'm good. Why can't I do it? I deserve it. I've worked really hard. I follow the rules. I don't have any DRs like these other people do. And what somebody told me in Recovery Dynamics was that if I wanted something like that to happen, I'd better start acting like somebody would act if they wanted to get out. Because maybe I wasn't ready for society. Maybe I wasn't. The judge and that probation officer labeled me as a sociopath. And what that means is I take advantage of you. And I don't want to do that anymore. So I had to trust that infinite God's wisdom and that infinite God's timing. And so to act like somebody would act like they wanted to get out of prison, I'd help them tote their bags and their trunks up to the laundry room. And I'd get all the size large dresses out to see which ones are better than the ones that I had, you know. And, yeah, I was going through the actions, but I always had a motive. I wanted to see if I had a better dress in the making. So in December of that year of 96, they come banged on my bunk and told me to pack up, and I was going to work release, and I was so excited. You know, I had arrived. The day had come. I get to get out of this place. And I went up to the laundry room. And, you know, somebody helped me tote my trunk. And somebody got my dresses. Somebody was watching what I was doing. Somebody else ended up with all the good stuff, all the good clothes and uniforms and all that. And it's pretty cool how it all worked. I got to work release, and I didn't know what to do. So I started asking questions, and they told me I could get out of that prison dress if I wanted to. So I went and pulled me on a pair of jeans, and I was up in my room, and I heard this voice that I hadn't heard in a while. And I heard him say, "Donna!" And I come trucking down them stairs. It was Diz. He come over, and he went to the work release center, and he asked Major Target if there was an AA meeting there. And she said, "No." And he said, "Would you mind if I brought one?" And she said, "No, we could use one here." So here's Diz, here's Tommy, and here's Angela, Lady Angel. Her name is Angela, and she brought a meeting there every Tuesday night. Every Tuesday night. I was there for 9 months. We had, when I first got to work release, I had 72 hours to find a job. And I went up to this major. And because she knew Diz, you know, I thought she would grant me a favor. And I said, "Major Target, would you mind if I looked in the classified ads and tried to find a job there?" She said, "Do you have a resume?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I do." So I showed her my resume, and she said, "Pretty impressive, but you can't keep books." And I said, "No problem." So there was an itty-bitty ad in the paper. And it had a help wanted, and it had a number, and it was for a receptionist job. And I said, "I qualify for that." So the officer on duty there called the number and got me an appointment. And the appointment was for 10 o'clock that morning for an interview. And I went for that interview, and at 1:30 I had a job. It was pretty cool. Yes, the interview lasted that long. The guy wanted to hear my whole life story, you know. And I was real new in AA at the time, so he heard a whole litany. I did what a lot of people think is a fifth step. Just kidding. But I got the job, and it was awesome. And I answered the phone, and I did a really good job at it. Got his office organized, and it was really cool. And through a sequence of God events, I ended up getting blessed with another position there, and it was a data processing job. And there I can get away with manipulation because it's data, and you have to manipulate it to do right when you're doing direct mail. And it makes it all legal, you know, and I can do it with a smile on my face. And the job rocked and rolled, and sequence of God events happened. And when I first was released from prison, which was September the 9th of 1997, Diz told me that I needed to go to a meeting that night. And I said, "Well, I don't have a car." He said, "You need to go to a meeting that night." I said, "Well, how am I going to get there?" He said, "You need to go to a meeting that night." I said, "Okay, I got that." And I didn't know how I was going to go. Well, Angela had a friend named Linda, and Linda offered to come pick me up and take me to a meeting. So she did. She came up just as prompt as ever. At 7:30, we went over to a group called Southside in Tallahassee, Florida. And it was a pretty cool meeting. It was with couches and chairs, and everybody was really comfortable smoking their cigarettes and all that stuff. I walked into that meeting hall. There was a great big chalkboard on the back, and there was a square up in the upper left-hand corner, and it said, "Trust God, clean house, and help other people." And it did something for me. Just reading those words did something for me. And they had this microphone at Southside, and they passed it around to everybody. Everybody talks and shares and all that kind of stuff. And I want you to know this alcoholic was in that chair, and I was so afraid that if y'all knew that I'd just gotten out of prison, you'd ask me to leave and come back whenever I earned my seat. Because I didn't know how y'all would be. I didn't. It was my first spot, you know. Well, then at the end of the meeting, everybody shared and all that kind of stuff. I introduced myself. "Hi, I'm alcoholic Donna Duffy," or Donna Arthur at the time, passed the microphone. And at the end of the meeting, they passed this basket, and somebody had told about these chip systems. And as the basket was coming around to me, I picked up a white chip. I had to pick out the cleanest one in there because, you know, I'm so special. It was a white chip, and I picked it up. Everybody applauded. I wanted to stand up and bow. It was great. It was great. So I wanted to come back the next night and pick up another one. They said, no, you got to hang on to that one for another 30 days, then you can get another color. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And there was a guy there that night, and he came up to me, hugged my neck, and he says, you just keep coming back. And I thought to myself, if you knew where I just came from, you wouldn't be telling me that. And what that guy shared in that meeting was extremely spiritual that night. And it was all along the lines of trusting God, cleaning the house, and helping other people. And shortly thereafter, Diz called me up and said that he wanted me to be the editor of the District 5 newsletter. And I said, I don't know how. He said, can you follow directions? And I said, yes, sir, I can. He said, you're going to go to intergroup, and you're going to volunteer. And then you're going to ask questions on what to do. And you do what they say. And then you're going to go to district, because that's involved too. And you're going to ask questions. And you'll know what to do. I said, okay. And I was scared to death, and I told him so. And you know what he said? He said, I'll help you. Wow. That was pretty cool. I had some guidance. I had some backup, you know? If I didn't know what to do, all I had to do was ask him. And he guided me right on through. He got me involved in intergroup. He got me involved in district. And he told me to go to meetings and ask questions and find a sponsor. He told me to find a sponsor. And I found a female sponsor. Her name was Nell. And I kept Nell probably 6 or 8 months, and she moved away. And I would visit her regularly once a week, and then schedules constraints, hers and mine both, conflicted. It would be once a month. And I was wham to Diz, and he said, that's okay, Donna. That's okay. I'll be your sponsor again. It's okay. And I'm like, wow, it's just so not a big deal to him. Everything, of course, about me is a big deal. It all revolves around Donna. Well, rock and roll along, this guy that I told you about right at the end of the meeting just told me one of the rules of staying sober in this alcoholic life is I couldn't date in the first year. I didn't like that. I didn't like it at all. Golly, why can't I date? He said, because men are one of your vices. I said, vices? He said, yes, one of your vices. You cannot date in the first year. I said, okay. Because of that fear of getting drunk, I followed directions. I did exactly what he said. Then I pushed the envelope about 11 months. And I said, Diz, I have this guy that asked me out for lunch. Is it okay if I go? You know, that guy in that meeting? He was on the committee for public information. And he wrote an article every month for the newsletter. And I don't know what happened. The email stopped working or something, and he personally brought the article down to me. And he asked me out on a lunch date. He said, would you like to go to lunch? And I said, let me call Diz. So I pushed the envelope with Diz, and I asked him if I could go to lunch. And he said, where are you going to go? I said, I don't know. He said, what you going to do? I said, eat. He said, where are you going afterwards? I said, back to work. He said, okay, go on then. I said, okay. I felt special. I had arrived. I could date. I went and had lunch. He came and picked me up. We went and had lunch, and he brought me right back to the office, and I went back to work, and it was pretty cool. And I called Diz when I got back to the office. I said, I'm back at work. You know? And then about probably 3 weeks later, this guy, I was coming up on a year, he asked me out on a real date at night. He asked me out to dinner, so I called Diz, and I told him that I knew I wasn't quite a year yet, but it'd be all right if I went out to dinner. He said, what you going to do? I said, eat. He said, what are you going to do after dinner? I said, probably go to a meeting. He said, what you going to do after the meeting? I said, well, I hope I go home, but if I go to a movie, can I go to a movie? He said, why don't you just go on home after dinner, and that'll be enough. I said, okay. So all through the dinner, I was expecting this guy to make a pass, you know, like everybody else always did. And it was probably me doing it, really, sending those signals, getting another victim. All through dinner, I wonder when he's going to make the move, and he was a total gentleman. And this guy, because he knew who I was and where I came from, he took me to a Japanese steakhouse. And I got to sew it up in 5 minutes. This is going to be real, real quick. He took me out to dinner, and he took me home, and he hugged my neck and thanked me for the date. And I went behind the door, and I said, wow, God, this is pretty cool. So he proposed to me on February 14th of the following year. That was 1999, and we got married June 26th. And this coming June, we'll celebrate 7 years of marriage. I've never been married 7 years. Never been married. Never been married 4 years. So every year's a celebration. It's really cool. Sequence of God events happened, and I was having some spiritual trouble, and Diz, you better get busy, you better get busy. Everything I'd say, I was involved in a big book study, involved in going to meetings, involved service-wise. We'd moved to Georgia, and I was just miserable inside. I felt like I was dying inside, and I was just going crazy, and Diz told me I better get busy. I didn't know what that meant. So finally, in frustration, I said, what do I do? He said, you better get busy. Through a sequence of God events, I ended up going to a meeting on a Friday night. Duffy asked me to go, and we went, and I got the great pleasure of being at the Bridges of Hope on a Friday night, and that was in March of 2003, and I have been going faithfully there ever since. I get the divine privilege of listening to an enormous amount of Fifth Steps, and I get to meet folks like Chrissy. She came through the Bridges, and she changed my life the day that I met her, and that's how it is there. That's God intervening in my life when I just get out of the way. God in His infinite wisdom will allow us the pleasure of living this life and trudging this happy road of destiny if we just get out of the way. God gets me right sized. He gets me right sized at the right moment so I can have ears to hear, so I can have that key of willingness to go on and live a productive life. Sequence of God events happened, and Courtney's daddy, Corky, sued me for past child support for all those years he had her, and he won. I didn't know what to do. I was in dire straits financially. I said, Diz, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, you better get busy. So I prayed to God, and through a sequence of God events, the job that I have today pays for that child support, pays for that restitution, and actually puts a little tiny bit of money in the bank every month. It's pretty incredible how this stuff works if we just get out of the way, let God work, keeps us down to the right size. It's amazing. You know, even on a bad day, I'm glad to be alive and sucking air. I love it. I love it. And I'm going to close with my favorite part. It won't take just a minute, Brad. It's on page 100. 100 in the big book. It says, if you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. It's pretty awesome. How many minutes, Brad? We done? Okay. I have a short story. There was a guy, he died, St. Peter, standing at the chapel. He says, do you want to go to heaven or hell? He says, do I got a choice? He said, yeah. He says, show me both. Takes him down the hall, opens the door, great big banquet table, big old pot of stew sitting in front, big old long spoons long as my arm, and a big old handle on the front. And all these people running around skinny, like bean poles, sad and angry and just pitching fits. And he says, what's wrong? He says, they can't figure out how to dip that spoon in the pot and feed themselves. They just can't figure it out. So they're real mad and frustrated. He said, can you show me heaven? He said, yeah. So he takes them down the other hall, opens the door, same scenario, big buffet table, big pot of stew, spoons laying down, fat people just like me running around happy-go-lucky, just like me. It was awesome. He said, man, what's the difference? He said they learned how when they pick up the spoon and they dip it in the pot, they can feed each other. That's what y'all have done for me. This teacher started the role. And I challenge each and every one of you, keep that hand out. Keep that hand out. Let that hand be responsible for that hand in AA. Thank you for saving my life.